My name is Elizabeth Evans, and I'm a homeschooling mom to four kids, ages 2 through 9, and we are learning how to make joy normal.
My name is Bonnie Landry, and I want to welcome you to season 2 of our podcast, Make Joy Normal. We want to thank everybody for their support and how much you've shared this podcast with your friends and those who you think it would be helpful for. I am a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a grandma. I've been homeschooling for 30 years. My kids are ages 14 to 33. I only have one at home now. I'm a speaker, a writer, a blogger, and I guess we're podcasters now, Elizabeth. And I'm an advocate of joy, so welcome to our podcast.
Good afternoon. So we don't have any news yet on Elizabeth. We will just wait and see what happens. I believe she's overdue at this point. But I had a new baby granddaughter last week. So we went out and saw her. So yeah, it was lovely. It was really, really nice to be there.
What number is that in terms of
that
your kids?
Grandchildren, that's the 7th.
Oh my goodness.
So we have now 4 grandsons and 3 granddaughters.
Oh, I wonder who the tiebreaker
would be. I know, it's very exciting. I did get permission from Elizabeth. I said, when you have your baby, am I allowed to announce? So I will announce that on whatever podcast I can as soon as we know something. So I have my guest co-host here with me again, Christina Jalloway. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We've had an incredibly mild summer. So it's only been in like the low 90s every day, which I know to some people sounds like, you know, Hades, but for us, to have low 90s every day in July is like, that is unheard of. We're usually hundreds by
Did now. You hear about our weather that we had?
You're having
it made national news. It was incredible.
Yeah.
It was really quite something.
It's strange. I mean, we're having mild weather. Y'all are having super hot weather. It's weird. But I'm thankful because it's meant going outside is much more pleasant. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Okay. So you have some questions.
Yes. So today I thought we would talk about how you saw the differences between the ways boys and girls learn, but also just parenting boys versus girls, how those played out in your homeschool and just in your family life. Because this is something that really fascinates me. I read a book called Why Gender Matters by Leonard Sachs, who is a pediatrician.
I've heard of this book.
And it's excellent. Pediatrician, but he also has a PhD in something, I think psychology. He wrote a book about the differences between the male and female brain and how those differences play out in all kinds of fascinating ways. And then this book called Boys and Girls Learn Differently by Michael Gurian is another book that I've read that I highly recommend to any parent or teacher. It's super detailed in terms of the brain research, like all the brain imaging they've done, you know, in recent, basically since like the 90s, this brain imaging that they've done on boys versus girls, the brains of starting in the womb. They've been able to see, okay, what is happening that's different in the brains of boys and girls, and shown that to many people's surprise, there are actual concrete differences between male and female brains that account for a lot of the things that we see that aren't just cultural constructs. Like the idea that, you know, girls all want to wear pink and purple and dress up as princesses and fairies, and boys all want to be truck drivers. Like that is culturally constructed. But the idea that girls like to play with dolls, for example, and boys tend to prefer toys that move, that is not culturally constructed. That's something they've seen across cultures that's based on the way the eye is structured in the male and the female. I find this fascinating. I was looking through this book just to refresh my memory on some of the more fun facts. And I thought I would just share a couple of them because I think that's so interesting. So even as an infant, at 1 week of age, a girl baby can distinguish a cry of another baby from other background noise in a room, and it will most likely distress the girl, and she will start to cry as well. Boys cannot do that. They can't distinguish the cry from the, from the background noise. At 4 months, girls can see faces in a photograph of people that they know and actually recognize them. And, you know, you can tell that there's recognition. Boys can't do that. at 4 months of age. When girls, so when girls start talking, they tend to speak much more, much sooner than boys because their verbal, the verbal center of their brain is much more mature. It matures faster than the boy's verbal center. So by age three, 99% of most girls' speech is comprehensible to adults. It takes age 4.5 for boys to get there. We just like the difference is so striking. And this is one of the things that I find frustrating about some parenting books and even some just educational philosophies is that they don't take into account these differences between boys and girls. So I think sometimes like speech therapists, I don't think I've ever heard in a speech therapy anything or any speech therapy information that there is an actual concrete difference between boys and girls in acquiring language. It, all kids are treated as the same. And if they don't have 15 words by 15 months, then they're, you know, delayed. They have a speech delay. Or just the idea that, you know, one of the things he points out in this book is that 95% of hyperactive children or children who are considered hyperactive in the school system by the time they're in pre-K or kindergarten are boys. 5% are girls. And that's not because boys are just like little devils. It's because their brains are different and they have different needs for movement.
Yeah, I always felt that the school system was really set up for females.
Like, it is.
It's much more set up for female success. Not, I, you know, intentionally, I don't think, but I just think that when you look back on my own, you know, when I look back on my own schooling, just seeing there wasn't that many boys in the younger grades who could actually sit, even in older grades, who could actually just sit in a desk and learn that way, where girls could, you know, the majority of girls for sure, you know.
Yeah. And part of that is because girls have a more innate desire to please the teacher because of the oxytocin levels in their body. Like they have this desire to tend and befriend, to want to please their elders, to want to please those that they are, who are in charge of them. And boys just don't have a strong of a push in that direction. So, and it's just harder for them to control their bodies because of all the hormones that they're dealing with.
Coursing through. And just as a point of interest, was there any things that boys as infants could do earlier that girls could not do?
Yes, they can motor play skills or much more forcefully with, like, they can manipulate objects much more and be much, they're much more physically active. So they're more physically active in the womb and they're more physically active as infants.
Right.
They have better narrow vision and depth perception and so superior perception at the blue end of the color spectrum. They have much more vigorous motor activity than girls do. Okay. So they're stronger, like they're physically, they have stronger,
probably more dexterous.
They're more dexterous. Yeah. Well, they're not as dexterous fingers. Their fine motor skills tend to not be as fine as a female's, but their gross motor skills, they tend to be much faster at walking, crawling, rolling, everything than girls do. And they actually have a much higher body, like muscle mass.
Right.
Even at age three, it's like really clear that they're bigger and stronger than their female counterparts. Obviously these are generalizations. There's always going to be exceptions on different ends of the spectrum.
Of course,
I find it really helpful for me as because I'm a woman, I don't know these things. Yeah. Like these, when I tell Christian, my husband, these things that I'm learning about the differences between boys and girls, and I tell him about the boy stuff, he's like, well, yeah, duh, that makes total sense. But he's a man. I am not a man. So intuitively doesn't just like spring to mind. I really wish I had read this book before I taught high school because it would have helped me understand a lot better.
I'll put these two in the show notes for sure.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I just wish I had understood, for example, that boys' hearing doesn't catch up to girls' hearing until they're in their 20s. Boys really benefit from being in the front of a classroom if they're in a classroom setting because they really cannot hear.
Yeah.
As well as the girls.
Well, I'll tell you something. There's a wonderful video by Andrew Pudua. There's something like teaching boys and kids who would prefer to make forts all day. Okay. So he talks about his experience in the classroom. And also he does a lot of like sort of class teaching for homeschoolers, teaching, you know, writing classes and whatnot. And he talks about hearing. He talks about body temperature. He says it's actually better to have boys and girls in different classes because the environment really affects them very differently. But boys up front, boys near the window, girls want to be warm. Girls feel more threatened if they're sitting at the front of the class, or if they sit at the back of the class, they feel less like somebody's kind of in their face. They like to be warmer. Boys like to be, they're more attentive if they're cooler. And he goes on this big explanation of teaching boys and girls really good. You'd really enjoy it. I'll link that as well. It's fantastic.
I'm sure I would. I heard him on a podcast with Sarah McKenzie, Read Aloud of Revival. He talks about how boys benefit from doing things while they're listening to a book being read. And so just don't assume that just because they're playing with Legos while you're reading that they're not actually listening. They actually might be listening better because they're playing with Legos while they're listening. And that is so counterintuitive for me. That is not how I listen. That's not how I learn. Because my brain, if I'm trying to focus on not many things, or like if I'm trying to intently focus on one thing, I can't focus on something else too. I find that really fascinating. So what did you see? What did you notice? Because I know you had three girls and then you had three boys and then another girl. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, our family culture altered radically.
I can imagine.
In the sort of the girl years, it was a very different experience, because quiet and they played a lot together. And I thought they were noisy because girls can be shrieky, you know. And I remember people saying, oh, boys are so much noisier than girls. You know, wait till you have a boy. And I thought, no, boys are. And then I had boys and it was like, oh, okay. You know, a whole different kind of noise, right?
Yeah.
A joy in noise.
Yes.
Noise getting them jazzed up and things like that in general. In the girl years, the girls, we'd read together in the morning, we would do our sit down work, and then they would play for the whole afternoon. And I was sort of like this peripheral role in their imaginary play, a lot of dress up, a lot of dollies, a lot of pretend games, you know, just huge imaginative, creative kinds of games. And they spent hours doing that. I just found that I sort of peripherally would just sort of pop in once in a while, and I would be either they would ask me or I would just do it. I would be part of the game. Like, can you be, you know, the servant who comes to our castle and you bring us a snack, right? Because they need a snack now. And so, you know, somebody needs to serve them and it might as well be in character, right? So everything was like that. Can you bring this and just pretend you're the servant and just, so they would prompt me on how I was to interact.
Oh my gosh, that's too cute.
That was one part of it in terms of just play and family interaction. There was also this real desire to be fair. They invented this game called the picking game. And they would play like Barbies or dollies or whatever. And they would get all of their stuff out and they would take turns. So they would say they were playing Barbies. They would pick a Barbie. Then the next person would have their turn picking. So before they started the game, this was almost a whole game unto itself, the picking game.
Wow.
Then the next person would pick and they would take turns. They would always start with the youngest and they would take turns picking things. And then they'd pick their outfits. It was just this focus on fairness and
cooperation.
They valued that, right? They valued that. So that was really interesting to see, you know, this sort of interaction of the girls. And I've always felt like I didn't have sisters, and I've always felt like it's a real gift to have sisters. And I've sought out women in my life to kind of have sister relationships with, because I think that it is kind of a lack, you know what I mean? It is what it is, you know, but there's kind of a lack there of this sort of sister relationship, which was just really quite lovely. So that was interesting. And there was just a lot of kind of cooperation about doing what I said we were going to do that day. So, you know, it wasn't like I was getting pushback. Now it's partly my own educational philosophy, forcing, not top down. There was just much more discussion about what we're going to do. If I said, okay, we're going to sit down and do, you know, this craft now, or was it going to sit down and do whatever now, there wasn't really pushback on that, right? So there was this kind of a compliant air.
Okay.
You know, kind of compliant vibe. When I had my first son, it was funny because the boy years didn't really happen until I had a few boys, you know what I mean? Because they were little and didn't really make a big dent on family dynamic. It was probably when my oldest boy was, you know, maybe 7 or 8 that things started to notice this real shift, and the girls were older, teenagers and whatnot. You know, so there was this shift that happened. But when I had Isaac, the girls would take him away, say 5, 6, 7 months old, and play with him. So he was like their live doll. And there would be an hour or two in the afternoons, a lot of afternoons. What's that?
That's an amazing deal.
It was an amazing deal. And so I would be like, whoa, I guess I'll go make dinner with no interruptions or whatever. And so they would take him away and they were really gentle with him and all that. But he couldn't walk and he couldn't talk, right? Because he was a baby. Size-wise, because he was big compared to them because they were children, they pretended he was older than he was. Okay. So instead of being a 5 or 6 month old, they would pretend he was, say, you know, 4 or 5 years old.
Okay.
But he couldn't walk. So they called him the lame Russian boy because he couldn't talk. And he couldn't walk. And so in his part in the game was he was the lame Russian
that is
boy.
So funny. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so anyways, in our sort of as things started to change and the boys became kind of an entity unto themselves and the girls were becoming young ladies and very, you know, a lot of decorum and things like that.
Not playing so much of the dress up and all that.
Mm-hmm. You know, baking and sewing and, you know, reading and doing, you know, helping me out and just hanging out, you know, doing sort of older girl stuff. And the boys were coming into their own. So maybe, you know, they're 8, 6, 3. And then from that point on, it was just a whole change in energy. It was like this total ramping up of energy and they were everywhere, you know, so they were just everywhere. And so, and weapons, like things that I just sort of didn't really imagine would be part of my life, you know? So I ended up clearing out underneath my kitchen sink and making an arsenal there because there was so many weapons and they were sort of laying all over the house all the time. So I just thought, okay, I'm just putting a big cardboard box here. When you're done with your weapons, put them under the sink.
Okay. Oh my gosh, that is so funny.
So the biggest difference I would say in the sort of day-to-day just raising a family was A, they ate a lot more. As they got older, that really came into its own. You know, they really needed to eat a lot more. They were just louder. That was just a part of it, but it was mostly happy loud. It wasn't, I would say they didn't ever want to draw their schoolwork out. They wanted to just snap to it, get it done. They would take breaks, which I'll get into in a minute. They didn't want to sort of dally with schoolwork, right? Get done what I want to get done so I can get onto my, you know, my other stuff. I found the girls tried to get outside every day, barring, you know, we get a lot of rain here. So that's the biggest reason why you end up not going outside. Tried to get outside every day. But the boys, if they didn't get outside every day, they would just kind of start to go stir crazy.
Yes.
And you could tell, it's like, okay, you know what? You guys need to really go outside because you're just getting super loud and, you know, running in the house and sort of playing tag in the house or tackling each other or whatever. So it was just way more physical.
Mm-hmm.
My boys were quite cuddly. I'm a cuddly person, you know, so I've physical touch is absolutely my number one love language. And my boys were quite cuddly, which I really appreciated because they were, yeah,
I
like
know.
Some more than others, but they were all pretty cuddly and they still now, like they all, you know, they're huggy. They hug, want to sit close to you and, you know, which is, I think is really lovely
is
because
really
I,
sweet. I have one cuddler, one non-cuddler. So
yeah. And I think it just sort of rubbed off because I'm like that. So those are the biggest differences in terms of teaching them. I found my boys cooperative, right? I wasn't getting a lot of pushback, but again, I think to some degree that was educational philosophy.
Yes.
They loved to, like, they would like to sit down and do some sit down work. And then, like, say I was sitting down and doing dictation and math with them, then they would jump up. And before they did anything else, they would say, can we go play outside and play road hockey? And so we would have this negotiation about, you know, I was never going to say no, because I know how good that is for them. But for them to just get out, and we have a circular driveway. So we have a basketball hoop in the driveway. And it's quite big, and they could rip stick. Do you know what rip stick is?
No.
It's kind of like a skateboard.
Oh, okay.
But it's hinged in the middle.
Oh.
And so you can go uphill with it because you can get it going. So our driveway has a slight hill, and so you can get it going side to side and actually go uphill with it, right?
Oh, wow.
So they had rip sticks. They had rollerblades. They would go out and play either road hockey or roller hockey. You know, we have hockey nets in the driveway and whatnot. So that was just amazing to have that real physical outlet for them. And where I live, you can do that all year round. You know, a lot of places in Canada, you can't. That need to get the physical energy out. And absolutely, when I was reading to them, they would draw, right, or play Play-Doh, but they would also get their little Playmobil guys. Mm-hmm. And they would actually be acting out little Playmobil guy things while I was reading, which seems like, how could you possibly concentrate? But they did. And they did a lot of that.
That's
so
you know, interesting.
I said, I feel like they're completely tuned out.
Yeah.
So I would check in once in a while. Yeah, you tracking?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and they would reiterate what I had said. And so, yeah. So those were some of the things I found were helpful. One of my sons is quite, like, very social. I would say that I would say they're all pretty sanguine,
okay.
Like get jazzed up by being around people. Some are quieter than others. One of my sons needed to tell me everything he was doing. So this is high school, right? I always made sure in high school my kids had a quiet place. For like grade 11 and 12, they all got their own room because
okay.
that was unusual in our house because we had lots of kids. But I would let them have their own room because that has a lot of reading,
yeah.
Right? Most of their schoolwork is reading. So I thought that was a fair way to sort of make sure they had some space to do that. He always sat in the middle of the dining room and did his schoolwork. And as he was doing it, he would say, oh, Mom, look at this. Come and see my biology for a minute. I have to show you something. And he would just like, I wouldn't understand half of what he was telling me, but he would need to say it out loud. Like that mm-hmm. was really, I think, how he assimilated information.
Extrovert for sure.
And just telling me, knowing I probably didn't understand what he was telling me. You're telling me some about chemistry problem or whatever. I think for him, whether that's common to boys, I don't know, but for him to be able to say what he was learning was important.
That's so interesting. And I think, you know, every kid is so unique. So obviously the brain differences between males and females are going to kind of play out differently with every kid. On average, males they do not speak as many words per day as females. Part of that is because they're the center of their brain that's responsible for language is not connected to the other parts of their brain like it is for girls. So it's just, they just don't have as many words. But, you know, some boys are just very chatty.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Some need to talk more than others. And some girls are extremely interior and quiet and, you know, they process better interiorly. That's just people, you know?
Exactly. Temperament differences.
Yeah. Did you notice? Because one of the big differences that comes up a lot in these studies is abstract versus concrete thinking. And for boys and men generally being much better abstract thinkers, especially when it comes to math. So like boys tend to do math in their heads or just on a piece of paper. They don't need to talk about it. They don't need manipulatives. Manipulatives don't really help them as much mm-hmm. as they do with girls who have a harder time with the abstract concepts, just kind of like imagining them in their heads. They need it something mm-hmm. concrete to help them. Did you notice anything like that?
Oh, for sure. And especially when they were younger, like I would say my daughters were all pretty good at math, but they didn't love it. Mm-hmm. You know, like it wasn't like they would get excited about their math book. They did it and they were functional at it. And it wasn't something that they were, you know, super jazzed about. It would almost always, for my daughters, it was almost always be the first thing they did, right? I absolutely noticed a big difference in the abstract when I was doing really as early on in math with my kids, because the girls had this really clear, you know, sort of concept of tangible things, right?
Yeah.
And that was really clear to them and made sense to them in general. And the boys, like the idea of sort of introducing a symbol to represent plus, to represent and, you know, instead of saying and, two and three mm-hmm. chocolate chips, that, okay, well, that many chocolate chips is five. So the symbols, plus, minus, you know, division, multiplication, equals, that was definitely an easier transition. And I think one of the things that's super important in all of this is that we just are very sensitive to the readiness, mm-hmm. right? And we don't compare our girls and our boys with each other, because our girls would always end up feeling like failures in math if they were, you know, whatever, 3 months a year, whatever difference in when they could do something in the acquisition of language, you know, our boys would end up feeling like, well, I'm not very good at this.
Right.
Which is a bunch of nonsense. All of that's nonsense. And even though the girls, maybe it took a little longer to gel, the whole idea of symbols gelling, it wasn't like it didn't gel. It was just something that was not as obvious to them. And took a little more conversation about to make that leap. The boys too, just a little more sort of understanding of language and why? You know, because language can confuse boys if they're mathematically oriented, and two of my boys certainly were. The idea of language, especially English, which doesn't make any sense at all, right?
That, no rule.
Well, why? You know, and I remember those questions of, well, why? You know, why would I come before E except after Z? That doesn't, I'm not getting this, right? Yeah. And so why? And they wanted to know where. I think the girls just accepted that more easily.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, okay. It just is what it is. It's more sort of intuitive.
Yeah, it's just the way it works.
So being really respectful of the readiness and the kinds of questions that they're going to come up with is such an important piece of the puzzle of giving all kids a good education. I think we always have to kind of come back to this idea of that we're teaching a child, not a subject. We're teaching a child, not a curriculum. And what does this child need from me today? If we can pare it all down to that simple question, I'm doing dictation, I'm doing math, I'm doing science, or what does this child need from me today? If they're not understanding this, and I explain it two or three ways and they still don't understand it, what they need is for me to back off. Yeah. Point in flogging something that isn't gelling right now. If the brain is not ready to absorb something,
yes,
there's no point. There's also no point, equally and opposite, there's also no point in flogging something that they already know because there's six pages in the workbook that say you have to practice this and they already know it. Tear the pages out, right? There's just no point in doing that because that makes it tedious. Challenge them without frustrating them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And that's a really important thing to always be aware of, right? That we're provide some little challenge. So what does this child need from me today? And that will really help us through the sort of boy-girl challenges, I think, when we stop thinking about, oh, they're behind, or oh, they should know this already. That's one of the worst things we can actually say to our kids. I think, and I'm talking about even discipline. I'm going to go off on a tangent.
Oh, please do, because this is
you should know better.
Big one.
Yeah. You should know better. When we say that, what we're inferring is you are dumb or you are lazy or you are defying me.
Yeah.
Right? Now, one of those things might be true. If your child did something yesterday and they won't do it today or can't do it today, it's possible that they don't remember. It's possible that they forgot. It's possible that they're not ready. It's possible that maybe they're kind of simple in that area and that, you know, they need a lot more support in that area. It's possible that they're lying. It's possible to try to get out of doing it. All of those things are possible. But what do we gain from highlighting that?
Yeah, it's a good point.
Outside of those circumstances, if you know, okay, this child actually does know how to do this, that's a problem. But it's not a problem that's going to get fixed in the context of trying to make them do a math problem you think they can do.
Yeah.
And forcing that issue.
Telling them, you know this already. Why aren't you doing it? Yeah, that's not helpful.
It's not helpful. And so if we can just kind of back off of that, whatever it is, the thing that's challenging them, maybe they're just emotionally not in a place where they can concentrate, right? We don't know, you know, what's going through their brains and their emotions. Yeah. And sometimes they're in upheaval that aren't aware of, especially when they're small. You know, they're just going through some kind of emotional turmoil that might be to do with growth. It might be to do with a fight they had with their brother. It might be something disturbing they heard you say. You know, we don't know. If we can back off, and if you think that your child is making things up in order to get out of work, that's a different problem than not doing today's math. And we need to pull back and deal with that problem as its own entity. If we can have the capacity to just not get caught up in this, don't make the math problem the mountain you're going to die on, right? Okay, we have a problem here because this seems to be consistently happening, that they're saying they can't do something that I'm pretty sure they can do, okay? And maybe some self-reflection is required. Pray about it. Okay, what can I do about this? You know, maybe it's something we need to talk to them about at night. You know, we're saying prayers with them. Is that, was I cooperative today? A little examination of conscience. Was I cooperative with my mom today? If you think they're trying to get out of something, you know, we can bring it up in ways that are very gentle and very tender. There's just such better ways to deal with that kind of thing.
So did you find that when it came to your children expressing kind of what was going on in their interior world, their emotions, did you notice a big difference between the way your girls would share things or express things versus the way your boys did or did not?
That's a great question, actually. And a bit hard to answer. To some degree, there was some boy and girl differences, but maybe not what maybe not what you would expect. Like, I would say that temperament-wise, that I have a couple of kids who are much more interior, who would have been more inclined, that I had to draw out a bit more. If I thought there was something going on with them, I'd have to work harder at drawing that out. So let's talk about sort of younger, because I think age and, yeah, and development makes a big difference here. So when they were small, I would say that that was definitely, there was a personality thing. So I've got a couple of kids, I say, with a personality much more interior, much less likely to share something, especially if they thought it was going to upset somebody or create conflict or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. I would also say that the boys all went through a phase of sort of in preteen and teen years that I ended up talking to some other moms with boys where they're kind of withdrawn and kind of sullen. So where they would have talked to me about all their problems and told me all that was going on, that was on their heart when they were young, there would have been certainly a phase of 2, 3, 4 years where they were withdrawn, pulled back, sullen. And what I realized was that's actually really, really normal, talking to other moms with boys, and they do get through it, right? We think of girls having the hormone issues, but the boys have them too.
No, not just the girls.
It just plays out very differently. So when you've worked really hard at having a relationship with your boys, that pulling back can be, feel, make you worry, something, this is how it's going to be. And what I would say is that my boys all pulled back at some point, some at some age, 15, 16, 17, you know, a little bit older, then they came back and they started talking, you know, if they had a problem, they would talk to us about it. They were having a problem with a friend or having a, you know, what a personal issue, that they would talk with us. And it was just a phase. It really was a phase. And very much like if I tried to push for information during that phase, that was not going to serve me well. So talking to other moms about that was really important when that started to happen, because I thought, you know, I'm doing something wrong for them to pull back like this because they've never done this.
I think a lot of moms feel that way. They're like, where did my sweet boy go?
Yeah.
He's disappeared.
Yeah.
Something happened.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know, I am thankful that I have the wisdom of other women who have gone through this before, who've told me, I mean, you are going to feel like you've lost your son to a degree because he has to separate from you. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of becoming a man.
Yeah.
Is that separation from your mother. But if you let him go through it, and you don't nag and you don't push too hard and you don't, you know, tell him what happened to you. You're just such a wonderful boy. And now you're all blah, blah, blah. Yeah. If you let it happen and let his development play out naturally while you're still praying for him and supporting him and loving him, he will come back. It's never going to be the same way as your daughters.
Yeah.
Because your daughters are with you kind of always. They don't leave their mothers in the same way.
In the same way, exactly. And I mean, now that my sons are all adults, I'm so, so grateful for the relationships that I have with them. And I'm so grateful for the mums that kind of helped me walk through that boyness. I was given two pieces of advice that I'll share with you during that time because it was just super helpful. Okay, wait a minute. How now have I forgotten them? One of the moms I talked to during that time, she had a big family. She had 9 kids and I think 6 or 7 of them were boys. And she was a real help to me at the time because they were the sweetest family. Oh my gosh. She had lovely boys, really amazing boys and helpful and mature and, you know, just really boys that you kind of think, oh, that's the kind of boys I want to raise. Right. Mm-hmm. And she was the one who said, yeah, it's a phase. They all go through it. And my boys all did that. And I was so surprised. Because she's also just very, very gentle mom, right? Lovely lady. That was a big help to me. But she said one of the things is like, touch them, even if they don't want to be hugged or they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to talk or they don't want to pour their heart out. They don't want to really spend time with you, right? And that was, yeah, you know, that was very, very much a phase. That, you know, make sure when you walk by them, you ruffle their hair, you put your hand on their shoulder, touch their arm or whatever. You just little things, because they still need that. They still need human touch. They still need closeness.
Yeah.
And so they still need you to tell them you love them every day. And they might, yes, grunt at you. They might not respond in the way that you know, hope they would respond or whatever. But, you know, I love you. And just don't take it personally.
Because it's hormones. It's literally their body is pulsating with testosterone.
Exactly.
That is why all this is happening.
Yeah. And they don't know what to do about it, right? So they pull back. I mean, I think that's very common that a lot of men, young men pull back. And I can't remember the other piece of advice now. If I think of it, I'll bring it up after, or I'll put it in the show notes or something. So I'll remember, probably after we hang up, I'll remember. So that was something that I think that where I think in general, not all, of course, and very much personality based, but in general, I would say girls speak a lot of their emotions that they're going through, and that,
yes,
you know, those hormonal times, growth times, you know, becoming adults, right? That they're speaking at you, and it's not always nice. Right. And if your daughters are ever having those moments, I think I didn't always handle those well. Right. So sometimes I handled them well, but sometimes I handled them very badly. But if I could remember what I was like, that was really helpful to remember that I just needed to launch. And my mom was the safe person to launch at. And so thank God, hard as it is,
you feel comfortable to
exactly
do it.
That this is the safe place. This is the safe place we can be. And so I would say there's a lot of sort of age related stuff, less than boy, girl stuff, except that it happens at different phases in different ways, depending on gender.
Yeah. And because women, for once a girl hits puberty, she's going to have a cyclical hormonal shift. Mm-hmm. Whereas a boy, his hormonal shift is so, it's just like this, a surge of testosterone during the preteen and teenage years. You know, his testosterone will be high in the morning and low at night, mm-hmm, every day.
It's not steady.
Thing.
That doesn't happen for a while.
It makes so much sense to me, mm-hmm, that happens because of the hormonal changes and how hard it is for women to understand and not to take it personally.
Yeah.
I think it's huge. I mean, I think that's just such a good lesson in parenting, generally speaking.
Yeah.
It's just to not take things personally, mm-hmm, when your kids are just growing and going.
I just remember the other piece of advice that it was a priest who said this to me, two things. He said, just remember, and this is very hard to remember in the heat of the moment, but just remember, it's not you. It's the mom. You're the mom. And so it's not about you. It's because you're the mom and you're the person that they can test these things out on, right? And their, you know, whether it's their ideas or their anger or whatever it is, it's because you're the mom. And so you know, remember that. He also said, when your children, not just boys, but when your children are asleep, pray over them. Right. And so, even if you go in at night, if opening their bedroom door would be an invasion of privacy or would be, might wake them up or whatever, just even outside there. I mean, ideally, you know, if you can put your hand on their back or something, you know, then sort of say a prayer over them. But even if you can stand at their bedroom door and just, I bless you, my son. Because, you know, our blessings are a channel of grace. And, you know, we just have to, you have to remember it. I've always said, being a human being, the hardest part is remembering. We usually know the right thing to do, but it's hard to remember.
And remembering and actually acting on those remembrances. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about how the Lord is so patient with us and so merciful.
Yeah.
And if we're meant to be images of His love to our children, to the people around us, I mean, when we fall, I mean, how many times do I confess the exact same sins in the confessional?
Like every time, like me, every single time.
And I've been Catholic since I was baptized as a baby, and I've been going to confession since I was, you know, 7 years old. So that's 30 years, and I'm still committing the same sins. Like, thank God he's not rubbing it in my face all the time thinking, you know better than that.
I know. You should know better.
You should know better. Oh my goodness. If that was the way the Lord was, I mean, we would be so afraid to go to him and we would want to hide.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that I've really been struck by when it comes to kind of a relationship first parenting, is that you want your children to know that they're so loved and they're so, like, not that there's never going to be consequences for their actions, mm-hmm, but that you are a safe person to come and tell when they've done something they know is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
that they don't have to be afraid mm-hmm. of your reaction. They don't have to be afraid of, you know, some sort of crazy punishment that you're going to give them. But they know if I tell mom I lied, if I tell mom I broke something, if I tell mom I had sex outside of marriage, whatever it is, she's still going to love me.
Yeah.
And she might not be happy about what I did, but I'm not going to be rejected by her. Exactly. Or
you always have to.
She's not going to rub my face in it, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to share an analogy that I think is worth sharing. And I'm going to just offer a little trigger warning here because I'm just going to refer to my own background of abuse. But if we raise our children in that sort of punishment-oriented, unsafe-oriented environment, you know, they don't want to come and tell us about the broken window. They don't want to come and tell us about, you know, stealing the cookie. They don't want to tell us about things because they're afraid to. Okay. Mm-hmm. And of course, you are not going to be mad at your child if they come and tell you they were abused. Okay.
Right.
But the abused always feel guilt. They feel like it was their fault that they were abused.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no way, if that's the environment that they have been grown accustomed to, that they're going to easily come to you and tell you that somebody, you know, assaulted them in some way or you know, abused them in some way. I know this from being an abuse victim that I felt total guilt for it. You know, I mean, I never did tell my parents. I didn't tell my parents. I wouldn't have. Not because they were harsh disciplinarians, but I think just the cultural vibe was terrified me. Shame and all of that. But, you know, if a child has feels like they can't tell you things. And of course you wouldn't. You know, what parent is going to get mad at their child for being a victim?
No.
They're not. But the child doesn't know that, right? They just know that they did something wrong and they perceive in abuse they did something wrong. So, you know, it's something you have to kind of reflect back on those ideas sometimes to think, okay, if I continue down this path of punishment and condemnation when my child's done something wrong, that's there's places where we don't ever want them to feel that they can't come to us, right?
Right. I mean, I think the difference between, I mean, from trauma, what trauma theory, you know, the discoveries of the field of psychology in the area of trauma shows us is that the difference between, like, you can have two people could experience sexual abuse, for example, or they did a study actually about when the Twin Towers fell in New York City. The kids who had a safe place to go home to after the experience, like the kids who were at school and saw the Twin Towers fall and were like traumatized by that experience, the ones who went home to a safe, warm, loving home where their parents were there and they could process what happened to them were not traumatized by it. The ones who went home to dysfunctional families where they couldn't process it with their parents, or their parents didn't have time to, or their parents weren't available emotionally or whatever. Mm. They were the ones who had the lasting trauma. Same thing in abuse situations. If you have a child who is abused and then immediately goes tell their parents, that's a child who's grown up in a healthy environment. And they know my parent is safe. I'm going to go tell my parent because that's what I do when something
fix the problem. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's there. That child is not going to be traumatized. Whereas a child who's grown up who's had some developmental trauma and has felt shame and I can't trust my parents because I don't know how they're going to react. And they punish me for this, that, and the other thing. So why wouldn't they punish me for this? And I'm not sure if I can tell them. I'm so afraid, blah, blah, blah. That's when trauma gets rooted in the body and in the mind. And so I think, you know, what we're doing with parenting and homeschooling and all these things is not just about training a child to do what's right and avoid what's wrong, or, you know, teaching them the subjects they need to know for college. Mm-hmm. I think there's so much of this that has to do with, it's so much bigger than that.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're really shaping the way your children are going to interact with the world mm-hmm. and relate to God. This is very far off the topic of boys versus girls, but I just think that that's what's become more and more apparent to me in my parenting journey is that if I'm consistently overreacting to minor toddler infractions, mm-hmm. you know, I noticed that when Nico, my baby, first started like pulling up on things, Joseph would knock him down because he did not want Nico to grab his toys. That was just his impulse. It was not premeditated. He was not being cruel or mean or anything like that. But my reaction was like, no, you know, I mean, I never yelled at him, but I was very, initially I was very stern because it was just a reaction. I was just reacting. I was not responding in any kind of calm way. I was triggered and I was just going into full on mama bear mode. I noticed that after a while, you know, of this, maybe just a few times, anytime after he pushed Nico down, he would immediately cover his eyes. It was like he knew what was coming and he wanted to hide. And that, you know, toddlers, they think that if they cover their eyes, you can't hide.
Magic.
So once I started to shift my approach, and if I heard Joseph push Nico down or if I intervened, I would say, oh no, what happened? And he'd say, I pushed Nico. And I'd say, well,
it is my job. Okay. He's my brother.
I was like, okay, well, we can't push. I know you know you're not supposed to push Nico. I bet you were just so frustrated. You forgot that you weren't supposed to do that. Once I started to approach it like that, he stopped trying to hide. And he was much more readily, yeah, I did it. Like it wasn't. And I mean, if I didn't know how 3.5-year-old brains work, I would be like, is my child a sociopath? Like, does he care about hurting his brother? But really, he's just so egocentric because all 3.5-year-olds are egocentric. He doesn't think about how Nico's feeling. And also, he didn't even think about what he was about to do. He just, his body was just like, push. That's
what impulse I'm doing right control. Now. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just think, like, I've just seen in microcosm how a lifetime of that kind of reaction, like, if you don't get yourself into a place where you're not, you know, where you're not just reacting all the time, where you're responding, you know, more often than you're just reacting, that can have long-term consequences for your kids. And so I'm just, yeah, that's something I've been really, really working on, is just taking the mama bear out of the equation and really trying to focus on, okay, how can I make Joseph know that even though, because he always knows he was not supposed to do that. It's not like afterward, he's like, blah, da, 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 nothing surprise. Happened. Yeah. He knows. But I don't want him to feel like he has to hide from me.
Yeah, I know. You know? Yeah, exactly. Now, we have about 5 more minutes. Do you have another question? I'll share a couple of stories if you don't. Little ones just...
I don't, no.
Okay, I'll highlight. I'll do a little boy-girl highlight because I think they're fun stories. One time my daughter was playing. She was maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7. And a friend of my phone, and she answered the phone. And she said, you know, she answered hello. And the friend said, oh, hi, Brianne, how are you doing? And she said, fine. And she said, what are you doing right now? And she goes, oh, I'm playing Lego. And my friend on the other side of the, on the other end of the phone said, oh, really, what are you building? And Brianne just was silent for a moment. And she just said, nothing. And she goes,
what was she doing with the Lego?
Well, she goes, the friend was asking her, oh, well, what are you doing with Lego? It's a natural question. Well, she would just build people.
Oh. I would...
Right. And then she would, you know, play Lego. Right. So, you know, they were in a relationship. Yeah.
That is Joseph's least favorite thing about, like, he does not care about the people at all. That is so funny.
You know, and so then just to highlight the boy-girl difference, then a few years later, one of my sons, you know, the girls were playing dollies and they dressed up a dolly and put it in a blanket for their brother to hold, right? And he was kind of, you know, he was little, maybe 3 or something like this. And he's kind of watching them and looking at them and they say, okay, now you hold the baby. And so he holds the baby, the look on his face was just like a psycho. And he just takes the baby and throws it over his shoulder. Like there was no, you know, no, I mean, he could be equally as tender boring on any given day, but it was like, this is fake, you know, and the girls would never have done that. They would have never tossed a dolly over their shoulder, even if, you know, they're fully cognizant that doll isn't real.
No, but you would hurt the baby. You can't do that. You can't even pretend to hurt the baby. That's not okay.
You don't hurt the baby.
Yeah, I asked Joseph once if he wanted a baby doll. I think because he saw one at someone's house and thought it was interesting, but never like played with it or anything. And I said, so you want a doll? And he's like, yeah, I want a baby doll. This is when he was probably about 3, so not that long ago. And I said, okay, what kind of doll do you want? He was like, a really small one. And I was like, okay, why do you want a really small one? He was like, because then I could throw it. I was like, so what you really want is just a ball. He's like, yeah, I think a ball would be better.
A Nerf ball. Let's get this straight here. Okay, I better wrap up there. But I will see you next week, and we'll have some more questions, I'm sure.
Thank you, Bonnie.